Voting has always been a cornerstone of the American democratic process. It helps shape communities, create solutions for complex and sometimes divisive problems, and it defines us as a country. Voting can also help to create an environment where bipartisan solutions are possible. Many leaders from around the country, from both the private and public sectors, are actively and strongly encouraging people to get out and vote to ensure their voices are heard, that their views and values are represented. From where I sit, there is quite a bit at stake for our country this November 6th. Please stay with me to learn just what is at stake when it comes to your health care and what you should consider when evaluating candidates and where they stand on health care issues. Welcome, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. And as always, we thank you for being a part of it. We appreciate it and you, because without you, why would I be doing this? So we're going to be spending the next hour with two people who are getting to share with us why it is critically important for each of us to vote for the health of it, to do our homework on where candidates in our state stand on health care. And I can assure you of this, regardless of who gets elected, your health care or that of someone you love or care about will be impacted in one way or another, which is why it is so critically important that you are making informed decisions. On a very personal note, I am asking family and friends and anybody I love to look at candidates through the prism of healthcare, and I can only hope that they do. Please join me now in welcoming Judy Rich, President and CEO of Tucson Medical Center, and Andy Slavitt, health policy expert and former director of Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, known as CMM or CMS. Judy and Andy, it's great to have you here, and also very important that you're taking the time from your very busy lives to get this information out before November.
We're happy to be here.
Okay. Andy, I hope you're happy too. Let's do this.
I'm very happy.
I know. Okay, let's start out with, you know, Judy, you've got a really big job. Every day in every way, your plate's full, demands on you are many, and yet you felt strongly enough about the issue to take a leadership role and help launch Vote for the Health of It. What is it? What's it all about? What do you mean by that? Let's start there.
Well, it's a fun thing to talk about because as we started to approach this November election here in Tucson, our communications experts and I got together and said, how can we get the word out to our own employees? We have 4,400 people who work here. They all have people in their lives that they can talk to and influence and educate. And so Julia Strange, our vice president, and I put together a program called Vote for the Health of It. And it started 4 weeks ago outside of our cafeteria. And it involved setting up iPads so that every person who came to the cafeteria that day and in subsequent days had the opportunity to register to vote online real time. It came about because we believe that voting by our staff and their extended community is a critical way for us to achieve our mission of providing exceptional health care with compassion. But we have to have the right people in the right political positions in order to make that happen.
And to me, it's so in keeping with all of the things that TMC does besides provide quality care when people really need it. It's almost a prevention mindset of, yeah, we better get the right people there so that we can have the health care that we need. Okay, Andy, there's so much for voters to consider when evaluating candidates and policy, and I want you to take all the time you need about what kinds of questions should they be asking. You know, my first recommendation would be don't listen to any political ads whatsoever, whatever side they're on, because there's a lot of hype there. But help walk us through what are the questions that we should be asking. What's at stake here?
Well, that's a great question. And I think you're right. I think there's nothing less healthy feeling than watching and listening to political ads. But actually, there's nothing I can think of that's more healthy and more empowering than actually going and pulling the lever or filling in the boxes and voting not just for your gubernatorial candidate or your senatorial or your congressperson, but all the way down the ballot. Because I think what we know, and as I begin to answer your question, is that in every part of the country, healthcare policy that affects you directly is being decided, whether that's in a state house, a legislature, the U.S. Congress, a court, if you're electing judges, and of course, in presidential years, the president. I think that there's a pretty broad contrast between what the messages of the two political parties are this year. If you look at the record over the last 2 years, generally speaking, the Republican Party thinks that healthcare is gone a little bit too far. It's too expensive. It is something to be pulled back. And their actions and proposals over the last couple of years were about cutting trillions of dollars from Medicare and Medicaid, weakening the restrictions that prevent insurance companies from discriminating against people for pre-existing conditions, and repealing the Affordable Care Act. You know, that's all part of the premise of the platform. Democrats, generally speaking, are for more expansionist policies. They believe we haven't gone far enough, that we're not insuring enough people, that too many people are insecure, and that affordability is a real problem. And I think both parties would probably agree that affordability is a real problem. I think Democrats and Republicans have slightly different views on what to do about that. Democrats, I think, want to really go at the cost of prescription drugs and negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies and do things that will reduce deductibles and reduce the things that insurance companies can do to make healthcare more expensive. Republicans have other solutions. Many of them involve limiting benefits or requiring people to work before they get certain benefits and so forth. So really different messages, really different philosophies. And while I think everybody at their heart cares about healthcare and maybe has differences in political opinions, fundamentally, I think Americans are what they're voting for this year is their ability to care for their family, their ability to afford to take care of their families if somebody gets sick, and to keep them healthy. And that's very much on the ballot.
So what about is under the, you know, in the scope, the target to kill pre-existing conditions? That's the thing that just blows my mind. People who have been sick, is that going to be on the list of things to cut? Is that something we have to care about?
Very much. It's very much, if not the major issue, one of the major issues. And let's just step back a second. For years, until 2013, the way insurance was designed is it was designed in favor of the insurance company, meaning it was designed in such a way to make sure that the insurance company made money. So if there was a chance that you were going to get sick, if you'd been sick before, it allowed insurance companies to keep you out. Now what's happened, and we live in a new world, where everybody, it doesn't matter if you're sick, if you've been sick, what your income level is, you're deemed to be entitled to have access to affordable health care. And so it's now designed in favor of people, of consumers. So that's a good change. And most Americans, you know, 75 to 80% of them think that that's a very good change. Now, that's under threat in a couple of respects. First of all, if the Republicans control Congress, they have voted over 70 times to repeal the ACA without a replacement or without an adequate one when they have. And so that would instantly get rid of the pre-existing condition protections. There's also a court case right now that the Trump administration and 20 Republican states are pushing that would also eliminate access to pre-existing condition protections. And so it gets a little bit confusing in the election year because in even numbered years, people read the polls and people don't like to say that they're against protections for pre-existing conditions. But I would suggest that voters look at the records of the candidates. The person running for Senate in Arizona has a strong record of being opposed to the ACA, as opposed to whatever rhetoric they might hear in campaign ads.
So, go ahead.
And I would add that one of the issues with pre-existing conditions is that if you take a sound bite from somebody, you might believe that that person who has great influence will be in favor of protecting pre-existing conditions. But one of the things that I have learned in my research is that the kind of thing that Andy was talking about will erode pre-existing conditions. So it might look to the general public like we're supporting insurance for pre-existing conditions, but in fact, it's going to be prohibitively expensive, or it's going to be carved up in such a way that at the end of the day, many, many people are no longer going to be able to get affordable health care insurance.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm so proud of myself for biting my tongue with my sarcastic comments, which is not really lend itself to what I want this show to be about. But yeah, look at people's voting records, not at what they're saying. And Andy, I actually went back and forth about asking you this question, but it's because of where you have sat with the really national view and being such a part of the Affordable Health Care Act and all of the good that it did for this country. But how do you know if it's a new candidate? How do you know they're telling us the truth? That's what we're having groups at our home, my daughter and I, because she's involved with the League of Women Voters. And how do you know a candidate is telling the truth? If it's a candidate that's currently in the U.S. Senate or the House, you can look at their voting records, and that stands on its own. But if someone is new, there is so much doublespeak and alt facts, and you know, it makes my head spin. Do you have any advice to us? How do we dig a little deeper? I mean, I'm sure. That's an honest question.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So look, the first principle, and you said it, but let's reaffirm it, is called votes, not quotes. Right? Votes, not quotes.
Love it. We'll use that in social media.
Right. So if my son comes home from school and says, Daddy, I'm doing great in social studies, and his report card says he has a C or a D, then who am I going to believe? What he's telling me or what his report card says?
Right.
This is the same thing. Everybody who serves in the Congress has a report card. We should know how they voted, and it's very easy to understand. Your second question is a good one. Okay, but what if someone's a new candidate and they don't have a record? What to believe? The first place that I look is who's financing their campaign. Who is giving them money? So if it's a candidate that is taking PAC money or is supported by super PAC money that's coming from, say, a source that is on the record for being against some of these policies that are helpful to people's health care, that's pretty easy to sort out. So what would be an example? I think that, you know, they're often disguised names and they're hard to sometimes find, but Americans for Prosperity is an organization started by the Koch brothers. They're very much against the expansion of healthcare. The pharmaceutical industry, they do a lot of good things for a lot of people, but they're also very much working for policies that make healthcare more expensive and have been part of funding the campaign to repeal the ACA. If you see a candidate that is raising money mostly from individuals and isn't taking money from PACs or corporations, then, you know, regardless of what they believe, you can generally tend to believe that they're going to vote for what their conscience is more often or what their district is telling them. When they get a lot of funding, disproportionate funding from some of these other sources, that's when I think you start to worry that the people who are elected to represent us may be, in fact, representing somebody else.
That is the best answer. You can say I have good questions. That is the best answer. I'm like, how do we know and where do we look? And that's really a good one. Judy, did you want to add anything to that vis-a-vis what's going on in Arizona?
Well, we are fortunate that both of our Senate candidates are on the record. And that's our biggest election here. So we do have actual voting records that we can use. We have to do a little work to know what those records are, but back to our Vote for the Health of It initiative here at the hospital, we have taken the time and the energy to put that out for our employees. So we have been able to break down by candidate what their voting record has been and or where they stand on health care if they are a new candidate. So we've done the work on that and put it out on our intranet for all of our employees. So they now have real solid information on the health policy position of all of our candidates in Arizona.
And Judy, when you talk about numbers and sometimes like Ron Barber lost by 167 votes, you have 4,400 people. So your educating of the staff is, I mean, could help change the face of Arizona. Andy, go ahead.
I was just going to say that less people think that this is a partisan thing. It's not. And here's my perspective. And Judy knows far more about Arizona and the politics than I do. But I would say from my perspective, from my national perspective, you have a governor who's a Republican, Governor Ducey, who's generally speaking been very supportive of policies that are innovative and expand healthcare to cover more people. And he's a conservative Republican. Generally speaking, you also had a Republican senator in the late John McCain, who also, as many people know, I think came down that way as well. So when you look at Representative McSally, who's running on the Republican side for the Senate, and she is very clear and on the record as saying she's opposed to the ACA and opposed to the things that are in the ACA by extension, like pre-existing conditions, you know, that's not a view that is exclusive to every Republican. That just happens to be her view and the view that she's put out there, and it's quite a contrast to candidate Sinema, who is, of course, feels that healthcare needs to be expanded to more people.
So, it's so reflective of the challenge, this question that I want to ask both of you. Do you see a scenario, if things do change at the Washington, D.C. level, can you imagine in this day and age, starting like right now, this minute, working towards bipartisan solutions? Because to me, I'll answer what I think. There are Republican candidates that are in favor of it, which is what you pointed out. So we're not saying vote for Democrats or don't vote for Republicans. Find out what their stand is on the issue, because those people will help get us to a bipartisan solution. What is your response to that, both of you?
Well, I'll start by saying that one of the things that Andy has taught me is that we have to be very concerned about the reality of what's going on. And he's an optimist. I'm an optimist. It's hard to go to the bad places, but I think if there's ever a time for us to acknowledge how serious this is without a bipartisan solution, it's right now and looking at the election that we're headed toward.
Andy?
Yeah, Judy is exactly right. I mean, let's not kid ourselves that if the president has a sufficient majority in Congress, let's not kid ourselves that one of the first things he will do, he considers it unfinished business, and so does Mitch McConnell, and so do many in Congress, to repeal the ACA. So, you know, that's a real threat, and, you know, we shouldn't pretend, kid ourselves that we're in a more harmonious place just because we want to be there. Having said that, even though it may be quite a bit in the distance, we can't give up on a bipartisan solution. And I think, while it may not happen in the next couple of years, beyond that, I think there is real opportunity. You know, I've had occasion to speak to both Republicans and Democrats, both in Washington and in a lot of different states. And if you get them away from the major debate about the ACA and pre-existing conditions, and just start talking about some of the more common sense things, such as, should we as a country invest more in mental health? Should we as a country invest more to take better care of kids and so forth? At that level of the conversation, there may be differences, but they're kind of what I would describe as more normal differences. That people can debate about and compromise. They're not the kind of vicious differences that we've been witness to the last couple of years. And so if I think the balance in Congress changes a bit more to have people who can block a repeal, and then we begin working really with some of those common areas, starting with some of those building blocks that everybody believes in, I think that's probably the best path to getting some common sense bipartisan things done.
Well, it's a perfect segue to the next question, because Mrs. Green's world is all about sustainability. And we often hear that the current healthcare system, the ACA, is not sustainable. And I'd like to know from both of you if you agree with that statement or not. And if you do agree, how do we change the course so that we can be assured that future generations have access to affordable and high-quality health care?
Well, as a provider of health care, I feel like I need to weigh in on our responsibility. We are an acute care system with reach into our community for community health as well, and we have a responsibility and an accountability to be transparent with our quality, to be transparent with our pricing. And there has been a fair amount of work done in the last 2 years at the federal and state level to hold all of us accountable to report back on the affordability of healthcare and the quality of healthcare. So that is a big step in making it sustainable, because the biggest complaint that we hear from our community and from our patients is the cost of healthcare.
Andy?
So I'll tell you, what's not sustainable is leaving people out of the healthcare system and making their first interaction with the healthcare system after they get sick. What's not sustainable is where we're living today, where one out of four Americans says that when they go to the pharmacy to get a prescription and they get the prescription, they can't afford to fill it, and they don't fill it. What's not sustainable is that the number one reason people call the American Cancer Society hotline is to say, I can't afford to have cancer. That's the number one reason by far that people call the American Cancer Society hotline. So those are the things, those are not future problems. Those are not things we're headed towards. That's the today of our country. And if you happen to be in the lowest income bracket, you have a 3 times more likelihood of all-cause mortality, in other words, dying early, than if you're in the upper income bracket. And the reason that is because people in the lower income bracket are a lot less likely to seek care when they need it. They're less likely to seek preventive care. They're less likely to have a regular physician. They're less likely to be able to afford their medication. And by the way, that's not just the lower income bracket. It's true for many, many middle-income Americans. So there's no perfect solution to any of these problems, but a solution which says, let's take a big step of the way there, like the ACA did, and then let's fix the things that aren't working. Let's work on them together across party lines, is the best path. And right now where we sit is we have one party that wants to fix the things that aren't working, the Democrats, and we have another party, the Republicans, who wants to find the things that aren't working and to tear it down. But it is far more sustainable than the system we lived in before, but we're not all the way there yet, and we need to do more things to make it more sustainable.
So a perfect segue for that is, let's talk about the Affordable Care Act a little bit. It wasn't perfect. It was the heaviest lift in my lifetime to change things from what it was. Many things were right. For me, two of my daughters and my grandchildren got affordable health care, which really meant a lot to me. They both work. Their health care was unaffordable. So when we're talking about vote for the health of it, I'm voting for the health of my children and grandchildren. Bring it on home. What was right, Andy? You know a lot about it. They got quite a bit right. Can you talk a little bit about that and why we need to build on it, not deconstruct it?
Well, so Mrs. Green, you said something very important, which is that it was a heavy lift, and it got it mostly right. And I think before we stop and look at what worked and what didn't work, it's really important to say that any major piece of legislation, Social Security, Medicare, generally speaking, is going to get it about, should get it about 70 to 80% right. It's just too complicated to be able to predict everything. But the idea always when you pass legislation like this is that you're able to then go in and fix the things that aren't working. And so that's a really important context, and it's no different than, you know, doing a big project at work. You know, you rarely get it 100% right, but you always want to have the opportunity to make it better and better along the way. Now, the things that I think went well, you know, we have 20 million more people that have insurance today. These are real lives that are affected, like your daughters and granddaughters. There also is, I think, as we talked about, this different compact, which now says that if you have been sick before, if you're sick now, if you are lower income, if you are out of a job, if you change jobs, if you want to start a new career, none of those factors should have any bearing on your ability to have health security for your family. So those are two really big things. Now, what didn't work as well is that it, you know, the cost of healthcare, while it's been going up at a lower rate, is still too expensive. So people who are not getting a subsidy from as part of the ACA or Medicare or their employer, they pay too much.
Right.
And so
right.
Middle-class Americans, small business owners, farmers, these are folks that are really the only people left in our country that are not getting a subsidy for their health care. And so they're seeing the full price. So until we do things, and this particularly hits people in smaller communities and rural areas where you've got very little competition, so we have to address those things. But I'd say, honestly, if you ask me the biggest thing that's wrong, that's broken, I'd say it's the fact that the two parties won't work together to fix the things that aren't working. Because there's always going to be things that need to be fixed. And the question is, do we have the will as a country, do we hold our politicians up to the expectation that they fix those things? And that's, I think, back to what this election's all about.
So I want to tie it into, like, make it all about me. And I don't mean me, Gina. I mean me, the listener. So I'm very involved in Rotary, and one of our biggest goals has been for the past 15 years to end polio. And what I say to people is, as long as there's one case of polio on the planet, I'm still at risk because they can get on a plane, you know, blah, blah, blah. Can you both answer this big, bold question? When millions of people are denied health care, how does that compromise the health of our country and all of its citizens? We don't live in bubbles. It's like my bias is showing again. But how does it impact us? And Andy, to your point, yes, it costs a lot for businesses. If they have healthy employees that are coming to work, that are getting their medical care, you know, their needs met and their prescriptions filled, I make the case that it impacts their bottom line in a positive way. It's the cost of doing business. And I know it's hard and it would be great to have it lowered, but can you both talk to about it, the health of the country is something that we should all be concerned about because it can impact and come through our doors.
Let's start with immunization since you talked about polio. One of the wonderful things that happened in the Affordable Care Act was that everyone was entitled to a primary care visit every year without cost. And those primary care visits are where the immunizations happen. So we hear on a regular basis about measles epidemics. We are hearing now about a very unusual spinal cord myelitis that's occurring in a couple parts of the country. We are at risk all of the time in this country for viruses and diseases that can be stopped with immunizations. And the people who don't get their immunizations are the people who don't seek medical care because of cost.
There you have it. And that's going to increase because of climate change. It's happening. More and more viruses, bugs, all that kinds of things being brought across the borders. So, Andy, your response?
So since Judy addressed the health side of the question, let me just address a different side. Let me address the financial side. Since I think for what most people, their biggest concern about health care is, can I afford it? So let's take a look at what happens if we take, let's take these 20 million people and let's assume they don't have insurance coverage again like they didn't before the ACA. So then what happens if someone, a woman, feels a lump in her breast, and let's say she lives in Tucson. First thing is, she's much more likely to ignore it than go in and get a mammogram because that's just money she doesn't have, and she may wish it away, and that's what generally happens. But eventually, she starts to feel pain. Maybe the tumor, she gets a tumor, it metastasizes. She feels bone pain. So she goes in to Tucson Medical Center, and she gets a lot of tests. The tests cost lots of money. Sometimes they can cost $40,000, $50,000, $60,000. She finds out she's very, very sick. And, of course, that's a horrible scenario for that woman. It's a horrible scenario for that family. But who do you think pays for the $60,000 when, and then the additional treatment, if she's fortunate enough to be able to get that treatment? Well, Tucson Medical Center is a community hospital. It's a nonprofit. You know, it doesn't have, without insurance, it doesn't just have money sitting around for that. So because of the role in the community, Tucson Medical Center is going to treat this woman. But what that means is if you are getting insurance through your employer or through any other way, your cost has just gone up. And so it's estimated that before the ACA, about 10% of everybody's premiums were paying for all of the bad debt and all of the uncompensated care when sick people who didn't have insurance would get very sick and have to go and get expensive treatment. So we're not living in a situation where you either pay for it or we don't pay for it. We will pay for it one way or the other. The decision we have to make as a country is, are we better off paying a little bit of money to keep everybody healthy or a lot of money when people get sick and then spreading that cost across the rest of us?
And therein lies my big dilemma all the time with that, the answer to that question. That is not a Democrat or a Republican. That's a really wise question to ask. The health of the country, none of those diseases, cancer, knows no party line. So when you're getting ready to vote, realize that there are implications for us both ways. We cannot dodge that bullet. So, Judy, let's talk a little bit about Arizona for a minute. Arizona was an early adopter of Medicaid expansion. And why is that important? And what will happen if it goes away? Like, I can't imagine that scenario living here for 43 years. What's going to happen?
I shudder to think about life before Medicaid expansion here. And I was fortunate enough to be here at Tucson Medical Center and with Governor Brewer, who was a Republican governor who supported the expansion of Medicaid. And I was able to watch what it meant to us in our community and to see the numbers rise of people that previously had the kind of scenario that Andy's talking about with prolonging or delaying medical care. I've been able to watch those people access care. And there's so much more going on in their lives than just getting health care. It's their self-esteem. It's their ability to work. It's their ability to rise up from difficult circumstances and be a contributing member of our society and our community here. For us as a hospital, it has meant that our bad debt was cut more than in half, and the trajectory of a nonprofit community hospital like Tucson Medical Center is in jeopardy when we go back to caring for people who have no form of payment. And it is what we do, and it is what we will continue to do, because it's our mission to care for everybody who walks in the door. But there are tough decisions that have to be made when people have no form of payment, because we can only keep them here for so long. Eventually, they do need to go home, and they do need continued care once they leave the hospital. I would just add that we're fortunate to live in a community with physicians who are not reluctant to care for patients who are on Medicaid. I have lived in other places where it's been difficult to find providers to care for people at that level of insurance, but we are very fortunate here that our doctors and our nurse practitioners are welcoming, and including all those people who've been put on to Medicaid over these last few years into their practices and to give them care. We are concerned that over the last year and a half, we're starting to see our numbers fall because of some of the things that have been going on at the federal level that are also impacting us at a state level. So we are watching it very, very carefully.
And everybody listening, watch it very carefully, because the life you save may be your own. And that is not a dramatic statement at all, as far as I'm concerned. Andy, I've always wanted to ask someone in the know this question, because there's always a lot of dialogue around this. But I could not wait to get on Social Security because of Medicare. And I will tell you, having been on it now for 3 years, it is a sweet spot. Why can't we do that? It may sound so naive and so uncomplicated, but Social Security and Medicare, it works. It's like it took away stress in my life because we were paying $800 a month for our medical care. So what is the Affordable Care Act based on that model somewhat? We have a model that seems to work.
Yeah, I'll tell you something interesting. In 1965, before Medicare, one out of every three seniors in this country lived below the poverty level. Think about that. One of every three seniors was, if that was the case today, then that means that one out of everybody's grandparents would either be living in their kids' basement or maybe even in their car. And so we're in a dramatically different and better place today because of Medicare. And in fact, Medicare has an 88% satisfaction level, which is astounding. People talk about what you did, which is that the day they turn 65 is one of the happiest days of their lives for that very reason. So this notion of health security, which is not necessarily giving everybody everything, but just making them not have to worry about being able to afford their health care, is a notion that Americans want, and they want it, and they say it in all kinds of ways. Now, there's lots of different ways to get there. None of them are easy. They all have trade-offs. But there's lots of good ideas out there so that we can be like other countries. The rest of the world, and most of the developed world, this is not something people have to worry about any longer, only in the U.S.
You know, I got a notice that our health care is going up $70, one of our supplements, right? And I thought, you know, we'll do it. We can do that. But I thought about people that I know that literally live on $1,000 a month or $1,500 a month. $70 is going to be a choice for them. It's like that's a thing, too, as I say. It's a thing. Because if you have such a limited income of $1,000 a month, $70, it's almost 10% of your monthly income. And people have to think about that. So, okay, let's circle back for Vote for the Health of It, joining the movement, spreading the word. What's your call to action, both of you?
Well, I'll start, and then Andy's going to be a great closer on this. For us, here at the hospital, we are not taking a position on individual candidates. We believe that there are candidates from all parties who have a strong record of supporting health communities and health policy that expands access, lowers cost, and creates healthy communities. So we are providing information to our staff so that they can make informed choices and vote for the health of it.
Love it.
So I'll just close by saying you can't improve upon anything Judy said. I can play that message over and over again. I would just ask you to think about one of the healthiest, happiest things you can do is to vote. Going and voting is empowering. It gives you a sense of control over your own destiny. your health care matters, our environment matters, whatever issues you care about matter, our democracy matters. And as Judy said, this is not about how you vote. This is about the idea of making sure that we don't decide that someone else gets to choose our healthcare future for us, that we get to do that ourselves. And so I think it's a wonderful and initiative, groundbreaking initiative that Judy has launched at Tucson Medical Center. And I think it's going to make a big difference.
I think it's going to make a big difference, too. And it makes me excited. And I'm so happy that we have this opportunity. The tagline for Mrs. Green's World is, we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And that's what we're asking of people. Every single issue on the ballot in Arizona matters. Corporation Commission, Mine Inspector, every single one of the little boxes that you get to put a dot in matter. So I want to thank both of you for taking the time to be with us. I am thrilled that this opportunity came our way. Thank you for what you're doing to make a difference for all of us. We really appreciate it in you. And my closing thoughts? Increasingly in healthcare, we talk about the social detriments of health, which are the social factors, where you live, your education, access to transportation, that impact your lifelong health, perhaps more significantly than your genetic makeup. To this end, when you step into the ballot box, or better yet, when you fill out your early mail-in ballot at home, think broadly about a candidate's position on healthcare, education, immigration, criminal justice, and about their ideas on how to lift people out of poverty. Why? Because in a sustainable and socially just world, we are all winners. Thanks for being a part of Mrs. Green's World, and thank both of you for making this possible. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.